Okay, welcome everyone. Very pleased to welcome as our speaker this evening, Dr. Michael Geschwind of UCSF Memory and Aging Center. Welcome, Dr. Geschwind.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Lori and Debbie.
So let's just go quickly through some basics of GSS. Some everyone on the call will know and some maybe not. So first, can you tell us what are the various forms of genetic prion disease? How does GSS fit in with that? And what are some similar prion diseases that can be often categorized as GSS-like?
Yeah, this is it's a great question. And I wish that the answer were very simple. It's a little complicated, but historically, genetic prion diseases or familial prion diseases were divided into three categories: familial CJD, Gerstmann-Strausser-Scheinker or GSS, and fatal familial insomnia. And this classification was developed before the gene was ever identified, before these were known to be actually genetic diseases. Some of them were thought to be diseases that ran in a family, but not necessarily thought to be due to a gene, maybe due to environmental exposure or an infectious agent like a virus that was passed down among family members. So when these names came up, familial CJD, GSS, and fatal familial insomnia, it wasn't known that these were caused by a gene, and actually it was the same gene that caused the same gene involved in all three of these forms of familial prion disease, the familial CJD, the GSS, and the fatal familial insomnia, or FFI. Once the gene was discovered, well, actually even before that, I should say that familial CJD, GSS, and FFI were differentiated from each other by the clinical symptoms that patients had and also the pathology under the microscope, the neuropathology that was identified at brain autopsy. And that's how these three divisions were made, excuse me, because they were all somewhat different. In the GSS, they found that these patients at autopsy, they had big clumps of deposits, microscopic but big enough to see under the microscope, of protein that we now know were deposits of the prion, the misfolded prion protein or the prion. And there were these big deposits, and these deposits had a certain characteristic that we call amyloid. Amyloid is just an ultra structure. It's a structure of a protein, and many different proteins can be in the form of amyloid. Prion proteins can be in the form of amyloid. There are proteins involved in Alzheimer's, like A-beta 42. That can be amyloid. The protein tau can form amyloids. Lots of proteins can have an ultra structure that's called amyloid. And so in the GSS, they found these big clumps of amyloid, and they noticed that this had some overlap to the deposits of amyloid that they found in Alzheimer's disease. But in Alzheimer's disease, we now know that those clumps were from A-beta 42 primarily, whereas in prion disease, in GSS, these deposits were a different amyloid. They were a prion protein amyloid. So the pathology of these is that you get these amyloid deposits in GSS. That's sort of one way of defining it. The disease GSS comes from the two German and an Austrian physician, Gerstmann, Strausser, and Scheinker, who I had written a paper about in 1936, describing a family that went back to as early as 1912 that had a disorder, a movement disorder. They had incoordination. They later had some cognitive changes. They had some early personality changes. Over time, we've now identified that about 23 different mutations in the prion gene can cause what we will call GSS. Another term that people like for rather than GSS, my colleague Bernardino Ordino Getty at the University of Indiana, he was one of the people who described a very large kindred of GSS called the Indiana kindred. And he now calls these diseases dominantly inherited PRP cerebral amyloidosis, which is a mouthful. But it's a more descriptive term because it helps differentiate all these diseases caused by 23 different mutations in the prion gene from the other prion diseases, from familial CJD, from FFI, and from others. So, that's GSS. Familial CJD is more common than GSS, and the mutations in the same gene, the prion gene, there are more than 20 mutations that cause familial CJD, and those tend to present clinically and pathologically more like sporadic CJD. They tend to be more rapidly progressive. They tend to not have the amyloid deposits. They have deposits of prion protein, but they're not these big clumps that form amyloid. They're just these tiny specks of prions throughout the brain tissue. So we can differentiate them under the microscope. And those tend to be more rapid, but some of the familial CJD cases can be long-lived, like the GSS. GSS, usually patients live in the 3 to 10 year range, but there's a lot of variability. Some patients have lived for 15, 20 years. Some have lived just for a few months with GSS. But for the most part, they live a few years. And for the most part, familial CJD, they live about the same, have same survival as sporadic CJD. So, which is usually less than a year, usually a matter of in the range of 4 to 7 months. And then the third type, the last type of genetic prion disease, is the fatal familial insomnia. That type is caused by one single mutation. Patients with that disease usually develop a problem with their autonomic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system that controls the bodily functions we don't think about, breathing, going to the bathroom, moving our gut, urinating, those types of things. So the autonomic nervous system, those parts of the brain are affected. It also affects sleep, hence you get this prominent insomnia. And then later in the disease, you tend to get more cognitive and behavioral changes. And patients with that disease tend to live about a year and a half, 2 years in that range.
But so, Dr. Geshwind, as far as the different mutations you were mentioning with GSS, how do those tie in to the different symptoms, the disease duration, the age of onset related to GSS?
Yeah, great question. Yeah. So of these 23 mutations, each mutation tends to have a certain, what we call phenotype, how they present. And so some of the mutations, patients present more with what we call ataxia. It's a problem with the back of the brain, the cerebellum. So there are problems with coordination, slurred speech, almost like a patient is drunk, has drunken too much alcohol. That's kind of what I would call ataxia, all the symptoms you would see in somebody who's drunk. Other patients can have more Parkinsonism, slowness of movement, a tremor, but not necessarily look like they're drunk. They'll just be very slow, like a patient with Parkinson's disease. Some patients have a combination of ataxia and Parkinson's. And then behavioral changes in some mutations can be very early and can affect the patients sometimes as early as their 20s or 30s, and then they don't develop cognitive or motor symptoms until much later in the disease. And of the 23 mutations, if people have questions about specific ones later, I can answer them. But usually patients with a specific mutation will have a general presentation. But there's a lot of variability, not only between families, but even within a family. Some patients in a family might present with personality changes. Others might present with a movement disorder. Others might present with more cognitive. So there's a lot of variability even within families. And part of my research and others' research is trying to figure out, why is there this variability? Is it other genes that are affecting it? Is it the environment? We don't know. Did I answer that question, Debbie? Or
yes, very well, very well. And can you talk a little about penetrance? First define what that is and explain,
yeah,
does it impact GSS mutations?
Yeah, that's a great question. The term penetrance means if somebody has a specific mutation, a genetic variation that usually causes disease. If you have that mutation and every person who has that mutation will get the disease, that means it's 100% penetrant. And that means if somebody lives a normal lifespan, you know, in the developing world, you know, through one's 70s or 80s, you have essentially 100% chance of getting the disease. That's 100% penetrant. But if only half the people who have that mutation statistically will ever develop the disease, despite living a normal lifespan, then the disease, we would say, is 50% penetrant if only half get it. Some mutations are essentially close to 100% penetrant. Some mutations for familial CJD are as low as 1% penetrant, meaning only 1% of people who carry that mutation who live a normal lifespan will ever develop the disease. Those are a little bit less common. In GSS, most of the mutations, to the best of our knowledge, are pretty close to 100% penetrant. I used to say 100% penetrant. But the truth is that there may be cases patients we haven't identified who have the mutation and never develop the disease because we just never identify them because they never get sick. The best data we have is from large families where we know there's a mutation and we can look at everybody who has mutation and we can follow them until they die, and we see if they die from prion disease or from something else. And most of that data suggests that for the people we know who have a mutation, it seems to be pretty close to 100% for most of the mutations. There might be some mutations that cause GSS that aren't 100% penetrant. And those are probably the less common mutations where we just have less data.
That's clear. That's great. So before we talk about my and everyone's favorite topic, which is, you know, where does the hope lie for a treatment, just one more challenging question. What can you tell us about age of onset and how that varies? And does that relate to the different mutations? And what, if anything, has been discovered about age of onset for GSS?
Yeah. So the age of onset is even probably a trickier question. There have been papers out there that have suggested that there's an age of onset and that certain factors can affect age of onset, such as codon 129 polymorphism. And I hold that data now with a grain of salt, meaning I'm a little bit suspicious of it. And the reason is because for years, it was thought that the age of onset could be, in some families, could be predicted. But I'm constantly finding families in which the average age in the family might be, you know, very narrow, but you'll find family members who develop the disease earlier or later. For the most part, what I try to tell families is to look at your own family, because your family is going to have the most genetic similarity to each other than another family with the same mutation. And therefore, the age that you see in your family is probably the best predictor that we know of so far for one's own likelihood of onset. But there's no guarantee. We just don't have that knowledge yet. So I'm very cautious when talking about age of onset. In general, for the more common GSS mutations, onset is probably usually in the mid-50s to mid-60s. That would probably be the most common. So it's a little earlier than for sporadic CJD. Can it be much earlier? Yeah, I mean, I know of a 10-year-old. I know of a 12-year-old who developed GSS. And then I know people in their 70s and 80s who have developed GSS. But those are very uncommon. Usually it's in the kind of 50s to 60s, but we'll see variability within a family. I put together a few papers where I tried to summarize the literature about the different diseases. And some of those I think are available online where I, so if you search for my name, and I put together tables of all the GSS mutations and what the average age of onset is for the family. Some of those are difficult to calculate because a lot of papers don't provide all their data. They might just say, they might just give the average, but we really don't know the range of those patients, or they might give the median, but not the range. Was that could I be more confusing or less clear with that answer, Debbie?
No, that's great. That's great. It's helpful, and we'll expound on it later. And so let's talk for a minute about where do you think, and we're in the hopefulness section of our talk, where do you think the greatest hope lies for a treatment, and what might a future treatment look like?
Yes, this is a very important question, something that we're actively interested in. So I think I'm in touch with many researchers who are trying to find treatments for prion disease, companies, academic laboratories, and they're all looking to, they have medications that they're trying in animal models. They like to get some animal model data so that they can eventually begin to treat patients if the data looks good enough. Some of these compounds are probably a couple of years away from clinical trials. If a drug has already been approved for another indication or has been tested, maybe not approved for another indication, but there's good safety data on it, that medication might have a greater chance of getting to trial quicker because of the safety aspects of it. For instance, a company might be looking at a drug that was used for diabetes, and it turns out it might have some effect, some safety, it might have some efficacy in prion disease, and that would be a really easy, quick drug to get to patients because it's already been approved, we know its safety profile, we'll know how to give it, et cetera. So the ways in which we're thinking about treating the disease would, number one, be to screen already approved drugs for other indications and to see if they might have effect in prion disease. And the way those are done is usually we have a cell culture model in a little honeycomb dish with lots of different cells in them, and each little well in a plate gets a different drug, and we see if it can clear prions from the cells in that little well. And you can screen hundreds of drugs this way, you know, a day. So that's one way that a lot of laboratories are screening. Another way is to actually go directly at the prion protein itself. When you have, when prion disease occurs, what's happening is that we all have normal prion proteins inside of us. And if one also has a prion, a misfolded prion protein, when that prion comes in contact with a prion protein, it transforms it, and now you have two prions. Those two prions come in contact with two normal proteins, prion proteins, transform them. Now you have four. Those four come in contact with others, and then you have eight, et cetera, and you get an exponential process. So if you could remove the normal protein, the substrate for the prion, then there's nothing left to convert, and you would have prions left, but you wouldn't expand the number of prions. And maybe the body would then have the ability to clear out those prions because there aren't more being formed. Probably what happens in prion disease is that as the prion protein is being transformed into the misshapen form, the prion, the body probably recognizes the prion as abnormal and tries to clear it out. But at some point, this transformation process of normally folded protein to misfolded protein overwhelms the body's ability to clear it out. So if you could stop the transformation from occurring by removing the substrate, the normal protein, then you might be able to slow down or stop the disease by allowing the body to remove the already existing prions and no more prions would form because there's too little of it to transform. So how might you do that? Well, one way that has been currently being used in treatment trials for at least three neurologic diseases is called antisense oligonucleotides, ASOs. And basically the idea is that we all have chromosomes which contain DNA. DNA is converted to RNA. RNA is converted to protein, like the prion protein. And what ASOs do is basically ASOs are similar agents. They essentially destroy the RNA. And so you can't make the protein. So you still have the DNA, but you're not, the RNA that's being made is destroyed, so you don't make the normal prion protein. And that's being used in a childhood, an infant disorder called spinomuscular atrophy. And that's a disease of the spinal cord. So what they do is they give the drug through a spinal tap into the spinal fluid, and they do it about once every month or so. They inject these compounds, ASOs, and they get to the nerve cells within the spinal cord, and they stop the production of the normal protein. We're trying to do the same thing now in Huntington's disease, but in Huntington's disease, we give the antisense oligos into the spinal cord, into the spinal fluid, but they have to travel not just to the spinal nerve cells, but all the way up, several feet up to the brain. And not only do they have to get onto the surface of the brain, they have to get deep within inside the brain. And we're not sure how difficult that's going to be. And the prions are throughout all levels of the brain, from the surface to the center of the brain. So, you know, we're hopeful that this might be effective by giving these antisense oligos into the spinal fluid, getting up to the brain, and maybe we can treat Huntington's, maybe we can treat prion disease, and maybe some other diseases like this. This method should work for all forms of prion disease, genetic, the sporadic, the acquired or iatrogenic forms, all forms of prion disease. The antisense oligos might have similar efficacy. So the big stumbling blocks are we don't know how much of the antisense oligos to give. We probably would give as much as we can. We think that lowering the normal form of the prion protein is safe in humans because it looks safe in mice. But we just don't know if it's really going to be safe and how much is safe. There are at least three people who have been identified who are living who only had one copy. They were born somehow with one copy of the prion protein gene, and they appear to have lived a normal life. What we don't know is if they had the normal level of prion protein. The presumption is that they only had half the normal level, and just like the mice who have half the normal level, they look normal. And so we're hoping that we can really reduce the normal level of prion protein by blocking the RNA, and we might delay the onset of the disease or slow the progression of the disease. Other ways of treating might be actually gene therapy, where we actually go into individual cells and we either cut out the bad gene or maybe replace it with a good copy of the gene. And techniques called CRISPR-Cas9 is probably the most promising technique. The big question with those techniques is we can do those in the petri dish, in the cell culture. We can do it maybe in localized tissue that's easy to access. But how do we get those? CRISPR-Cas9 is a form of, think of it as a molecular scissors that actually go into the cell, go into the nucleus of the cell where the chromosomes are, and they can be targeted to the gene of interest, and they can bind to the gene of interest and stop it from working, or they can bind and actually cut it out and replace it with a normal copy. Many different ways of doing that. But how we would actually take that, those molecular scissors, and get them into the cells in the brain that need to be gotten to, we don't have the technology to do that yet. But lots of people are working on that. But so that's another area of promise. One way we might do it is by injecting viruses that can express DNA and make proteins directly where we want them. So they're basically viruses of these factories that can make the DNA or the protein of interest in the cells that you want. And in fact, we're beginning a treatment trial with viral vector gene therapy in Huntington's disease at our center. We're in the midst of starting it. Hopefully we'll start early next year. And if the techniques works in Huntington's disease, maybe similar techniques could work for prion disease. In the future, I could see patients getting both methods. The viral vectors we can directly inoculate into the center of the brain. The problem with them is that we can probably get small areas of the brain, but we can't get the whole surface of the brain very easily. Whereas the antisense oligos are the opposite. They have access to the surface of the brain because that's what's bathed in the spinal fluid and they're floating in. So maybe a combination of antisense oligos and doing direct injection into the center of the brain might be the way we're treating these diseases in 5 or 10 years. So those are, I'd say, some of the more promising things. And the antisense oligos, when I talked to one of the companies that's involved in it, they think they could be as close as 2 years away from first-in-human trials, assuming that the animal data continues to look good and that the safety data looks good. I'll stop there for a second.
Okay, great. Well, that's a great way to end our recorded portion of our call. So I'll ask Lori to turn off the recording, and then we'll open up for questions for the group.